The 15 spirits in Carmen were foaming and frothing, wailing and hissing. Hank held Carmen down gently, one hand on her right hand, one hand on her left shoulder. Mary stood beside him, clinging to him a little out of her own timidity. Carmen moaned and twisted, her eyes glaring at Hank.
"Let us go, praying man,"
Carmen's voice warned, and the sulphurous odor coming from deep inside her was strong and nauseating. "Carmen, do you want to be delivered?" Hank asked.
"She can't hear you," said the spirits. "Let us alone. She belongs to us."
"Be silent and come out of her."
"No!"
Carmen screamed, and Mary was almost sure she saw a puff of yellow vapor from Carmen's throat. "Come out in the name of Jesus," said Hank. The bomb exploded. Hank was thrown backward. Mary leaped aside. Carmen was on top of Hank, clawing, biting, mauling. Her teeth clamped into his right arm. He pushed and pounded with his left. "Demon, let go," he ordered. The jaws opened. Hank gave all the shove he had, and Carmen's body staggered backward, twitching and shrieking. Her hands found a chair. Instantly it shot upward and came down with a crash, but Hank scurried out of the way. He dove for Carmen and tackled her as she was grabbing another chair. Her leg came up like a catapult and flung him across the room where he thudded into the wall. Her fist was right behind him. He dodged it. It rammed a hole in the plaster. He was looking into the eyes of a beast. He smelled the sulphurous breath hissing through the bared teeth. He jerked himself away. Sharp fingernails snagged and tore at his shirt. Some dug into his flesh. He could hear Mary screaming,
"Stop it, spirit! In Jesus' name, stop it!"
Carmen doubled over and clapped her hands over her ears. She staggered and screamed. "Be silent, demon, and come out of her," Hank ordered, trying to keep his distance.
"I won't! I won't!"
Carmen screamed, and her body careened toward the front door. She hit it full force. The center of the door caved in with a loud crack. Hank ran to the door and pulled it open, and Carmen flew out the door and down the street. As Hank and Mary watched her go, all they could do was hope the neighbors wouldn't see.
"Sandy," said Marshall, "this isn't you. I know it isn't you."
She said nothing, but like the strike of a rattlesnake, she pounced at him, trying to get through the door. He held his hands up to protect his face from her flying fists.
"Okay, okay," he told her, stepping aside. "You can go. Just remember, I love you."
She grabbed her suitcase and a shopping bag and bolted for the front door. He followed her down the hall toward the living room. He came around the corner. He looked to see her, but all he saw was the lamp that smacked into his skull. He heard and felt the blow in every part of his body. The lamp fell to the floor with a crash. Now he was on one knee, slumped against the couch. His hand went to his head. He looked up and saw the front door still standing open. He was bleeding. His head was so light he was afraid to try to stand up. His strength was gone anyway. Nuts, now there's blood on the rug. What will Kate say?
"Marshall,"
came a voice above him. A hand rested on his shoulder. It was a woman. "Kate? Sandy?" No, Bernice, squinting at him through blackened eyes.
"Marshall, what happened? Are you still there?"
"Help me clean up this mess," was all he could say.
She scurried into the kitchen and found some paper towels. She brought them back and pressed a wad of them against his head. He winced at the pain. She asked him,
"Can you get up?"
"I don't want to get up," he answered crossly.
"Okay, okay. I just saw Sandy drive off. Was this her doing?"
"Yeah, she pitched that lamp at me."
"It must have been something you said. Here, hold still."
"She's not herself at all. She's gone crazy."
"Where's Kate?"
"She's left me."
Bernice settled to the floor, her bruised face the picture of shock, dismay, and exhaustion. Neither of them said anything for a few moments. They just stared at each other like two shot-up soldiers in a foxhole.
"Man, you're a mess," Marshall finally observed.
"At least the swelling's gone down. Don't I look foxy?"
"More like a raccoon. I thought you were supposed to be resting at home. What are you doing here, anyway?"
"I just got back from Baker. And I have nothing but bad news from there, too."
He anticipated it.
"Weed?"
"He's dead. The truck he was driving went off the Judd River Bridge and into that big canyon. We were supposed to have met each other. He'd just gotten a call from Susan Jacobson, and it sounded pretty important.
Marshall's head fell back against the couch, and he closed his eyes.
Great. Just great. He wanted to die.
He called me this afternoon, and we set up the appointment. I imagine either my phone or his was bugged. That accident was set up, I'm sure of it. I got out of there fast.
Marshall took the wad from his head and looked at the blood on it. He placed it back over the gash.
"We're going down, Bernie," he said, and went on to tell her about his whole afternoon, his meeting with Brumell and Brumell's buddies, his loss of the house, his loss of the paper, his loss of Kate, of Sandy, of everything. "And did you know that I've made it a habit to molest my daughter, besides having an affair with my reporter?"
"They're cutting you up into little pieces, aren't they?"
she said very quietly, her throat constricted with fear.
"What can we do?"
"We can get the heck out of here, that's what we can do."
"You're going to give up?"
Marshall only let his head sink downward. He was tired.
"Let somebody else fight this war. We were warned, Bernie, and we didn't listen. They got me. They got all our records, any proof we ever had. Harmel blew his brains out. Strawn's getting as far away from it as he can. They took out Weed. Right now, I think I'm just barely alive, and that's all I have left."
"What about Susan Jacobson?"
It took some extra effort and willpower to make himself think about it.
"I wonder if she even exists, and if so, if she's alive."
"Kevin said she had the goods, and she was getting ready to get out of wherever she was. That sounds to me like a defection. And if she has the evidence we need to seal this thing up..."
"They took care of that, Bernie, remember? Weed was our last contact with her."
"Want a toy with a theory?"
"No."
"If Kevin's phone was bugged, they know what Weed and Susan talked about. They heard it all."
"Naturally, and Susan's as good as dead, too."
"We don't know that. Maybe she managed to get away. Maybe she was going to meet Kevin someplace."
"Eh?"
Marshall passively listened.
"What I'm toying with is that somewhere there must be a recording in somebody's hands of that phone call."
"Yeah, I suppose there is."
Marshall felt half dead, but the half of him that was still alive was thinking.
"But where would it be? This is a big country, Bernie."
"Well, like I said, it's a theory to toy with. It's all we have left, really."
"Which sure isn't much."
"I'm dying to know what Susan had to say."
"Please, don't use that word, dying."
"Well, think for a minute, Marshall. Think of all the people who seem to have responded to the alleged bug. There were the Windsor cops who knew they could find you at Strawn's after you told me you'd be there."
"It's not likely they'd have the recording equipment. They're too far away."
"So somebody who did have the recording equipment must have tipped them off."
Marshall got an idea, and a little bit of color returned to his face.
"I'm wondering about Brumell."
Bernice's eyes brightened.
"Sure. Like I said, he and the cops in Windsor are in cahoots all the time."
"He fired Sarah, you know. She wasn't there today. She'd been replaced."
New ideas began to form in Marshall's mind.
"Yeah. She talked to me on the phone and ratted on Brumell a little. She said she'd help me out if I could help her out. We agreed to deal, and Brumell fired her. He must have heard that conversation, too."
Then it hit him.
"Yeah, Sarah, those filing cabinets. Brumell's filing cabinets."
"Yeah, you're cooking, Marshall. Just keep going."
"He had his filing cabinets moved out into Sarah's reception area to make room for some new office equipment. I saw it there, sitting right in his office, and there was a wire coming out of the wall. He said it was for the coffee maker, but I didn't see any coffee maker."
"I think you might have it there."
"It was telephone wire, not appliance cord."
Excitement made his head hurt, but he said anyway,
"Bernice, it was telephone wire."
"If we could find out for sure that the recording equipment is there in his office... If we could find any tapes of phone conversations, Well, that might be enough to bring some kind of charges, at least. Illegal wiretapping?
Murder. That was a chilling thought. We need Sarah, Marshall added. If she's on our side, now's when she can prove it.
Whatever you do, don't call her. I know where she lives.
Help me up.
You help me up.
Chapter 31. Hank and Mary were still shaking as he took a careful look at the front door. He shook his head and whistled his astonishment.
Whew, she cracked the door jam. Look at this. The stop has moved out about an inch.
Well, how about changing your shirt? Mary asked, and Hank remembered that half his shirt was gone.
Here's another one for the rag box, he said, slipping the shirt off. Then he winced a little.
Ooh, what's wrong?
As the shirt came off, Hank raised his arm to have a look, and Mary gasped. Carmen's teeth had made some very impressive welts. The skin was broken in some places.
We'd better put some peroxide on those, said Mary, hurrying into the bathroom. Come here.
Hank went into the bathroom, still carrying the torn shirt. He held his arm out over the sink, and Mary started dabbing the wounds. She was astonished.
Goodness! Hank, she bit you in four different places. Look at this.
Boy, I hope she's had all her shots.
I knew that woman was up to no good the first time I saw her.
The doorbell rang. Hank and Mary looked at each other. What now?
Better go answer it, said Hank.
She went out into the living room while Hank finished cleaning his arm.
Hank, Mary called, I think you'd better come out here.
Hank went out into the living room, still carrying the torn shirt in his hand and sporting the bite marks on his arm. Two policemen stood at the door, an older, taller one, and a younger, new on the force type. Yeah, the neighbors must have thought something terrible was happening in here. Come to think of it, they were right.
Hi there, said Hank.
Hank Bush?
The older one asked.
Yeah, he answered. This is Mary, my wife. You must have received a call from the neighbors, right?
The big officer was looking at Hank's arm.
What happened to your arm?
Well, Hank wasn't sure how to answer. Even the truth would sound like a pretty tall tale. No matter, he didn't have time. The younger officer grabbed Hank's shirt right out of his hand and unfolded it, holding it up in both hands. The older one happened to have the rest of Hank's shirt discreetly hidden behind his back. Now he produced the torn piece and made a quick comparison of the materials. The older one nodded to the younger one, and the younger one got out a pair of handcuffs and rather forcefully twisted Hank around. Mary's mouth dropped open, and she squealed,
"What on earth are you doing?"
The older one started rattling off the prisoner's liturgy.
"Mr. Bush, we're placing you under arrest. It's my duty to advise you of your rights. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you."
Hank had an idea, but he asked anyway.
Mind telling me what the charges are?"
"You ought to know," snapped the older one.
"Suspected rape," said the younger.
"What?"
Mary exclaimed. The younger one held up his hand as a warning.
"Just stay out of this, lady." "You're making a mistake," she pleaded.
The two officers led Hank down the front walk. It happened so fast that Mary hardly knew what to do. She ran after them, pleading, trying to reason with them.
"This is crazy. I don't believe this," she said.
The younger one just told her,
"You'll have to stay out of the way or face charges of obstructing justice."
"Justice," she cried. "You call this justice? Hank, what should I do?"
"Make some calls," Hank answered.
"I'm going with you."
"We can't allow you in the squad car, ma'am," said the older one.
"Make some calls, Mary," Hank repeated. They strong-armed him into the car and closed the door. The two officers got in, and away they went, down the street, around the corner, and out of sight. And Mary remained there on the curb all by herself, without her husband. Just like that. Tal and his warriors and couriers knew where to look, and they knew what to listen for. So they heard the telephones ringing all over town. They saw the many people roused from their televisions or from their sleep by the phone calls. The entire remnant was buzzing with the news of Hank's arrest. The praying began.
"Bush has fallen," said Tal. "Only Hogan remains."
He turned to Kaiman and Mota. Does Sarah have the keys?
Kaiman answered. She had several keys copied before she left her job at the police station.
Mota looked across the town as he said, They should be meeting with her right about now. Sarah, Bernice, and Marshall conferred in a tight, hushed little huddle in the middle of Sarah's small kitchen. Except for the light from one lamp out in the dining room, there were no other lights on in the house. Sarah was still up, fully dressed. She was packing to move.
I'll take whatever I can squeeze into my car, but I'm not staying around past tomorrow, especially after tonight, she said in a near whisper.
How are you set for money? Marshall asked.
I've enough gas money to get out of the state, and after that I don't know. Vermel didn't give me any severance pay.
Just booted you right out?
He didn't say so, but I've no doubt he overheard that conversation I had with you. I didn't survive very long after that.
Marshall handed her $100.
I'd give you more if I had it.
That's all right. I'd say we have a deal.
Sarah passed a set of keys to him.
Now listen carefully. This one here is for the main door, but first you have to deactivate the burglar alarm. That's this little key here. The box is around the back, just above the garbage cans. You just open the cover and flip the switch off. This key here with the round head is to Brumell's office. I don't know if that equipment is locked up or not, but I don't have any key for it. You'll just have to take the risk. The night dispatcher is still posted at the fire station, so there shouldn't be anyone else there.
What do you think of our theory? Bernice asked.
I know Brumell's very protective of that new equipment in there. Ever since he's had it installed, I've not been allowed in his office, and he keeps the door closed. It's the first place I'd look.
We'd better go, Marshall said to Bernice.
Bernice gave Sarah a hug.
Good luck. Good luck yourselves, Sarah replied. Be very quiet going out.
They sneaked away in the darkness. Later that night, Marshall picked up Bernice at her apartment and they rode together downtown. Marshall found a good spot to hide the Buick just a few blocks from Courthouse Square, a nice vacant lot with lots of overgrown shrubs and trees. He slipped the big car down into the jungle and turned off the engine. For a moment, he and Bernice just sat there, wondering what the next move should be. They thought they were ready. They had even changed into dark clothes, and they had brought flashlights and rubber gloves.
Sheesh, said Marshall. The last time I did something like this was when we kids stole the neighbor's corn.
How did that turn out?
We got caught, and boy, did we get it.
What time does your watch say?
Marshall checked his watch with his flashlight.
1:25.
Bernice was clearly nervous.
I wonder if real burglars work this way. I feel I'm in some kind of hokey movie.
How about some charcoal for your face?
It's black enough now, thank you.
They both sat there for a few more moments, trying to build up the nerve to proceed. Bernice finally said,
Well, are we going to do it or aren't we?
Die all, die merrily, Marshall replied, opening the door.
They tiptoed up an alley and through a few yards until they reached the back of the courthouse police station. Fortunately, the town hadn't gotten the funds together yet for any floodlights over the parking lot, so the darkness was pretty concealing. Bernice couldn't help feeling petrified. Only sheer determination kept her carrying on. Marshall was nervous, but for some reason he felt an odd exhilaration in doing something so sneaky and dirty against these enemies. As soon as they had crossed the parking lot, they ducked into a nearby shadow and stood tightly against the wall. It was so nice and dark there that Bernice didn't want to leave. About 20 feet down the wall were the garbage cans, and above them a small gray panel. Marshall got there quickly, found the right key, opened the little door, and found the switch. He signaled to Bernice, and she followed him. They walked quickly around to the front of the building, and now they were in the open, facing the large parking area between the police station and the town hall. Marshall had the key ready, and they were able to get into the building without delay. Marshall quickly closed the door behind them. They rested just a minute and listened. The place was deserted and dead quiet. They heard no sirens or alarms going off. Marshall found the next key and went to Brumell's office door. So far, Sarah had predicted right on the money.
Brummel's door opened too. They both ducked inside. And there sat the cabinetry housing the mysterious equipment, if it was truly there. Marshall clicked on his flashlight and kept the beam subdued under his hand so that it would not play on the walls or shine out the window. Then he swung open the lower left cabinet door. Inside he found some shelves on roller tracks. He pulled the upper one out. And there sat a recording machine with a good supply of tape.
"Eureka!" Bernice whispered. "Must be signal activated. Switches on automatically whenever an input comes in."
Bernice clicked on her flashlight and checked the other door on the lower right. Here she found some files and folders.
"It looks like a catalog," she said. "Look, names, dates, conversations, and what tape they're on." "That handwriting looks familiar."
They were both astounded at how many names were on the list, how many people were being listened in on.
"Even network people," Marshall observed.
Then he pointed to a listing near the bottom of one page.
"There we are."
He was right. The Clarion phone was listed, the conversation noted as being between Marshall and Ted Harmel, recorded on tape 5A.
"Who in the world has the time to list all this stuff?" Bernice wondered.
Marshall only shook his head. Then he asked,
"When was that conversation between Susan and Weed?"
Bernice thought for a moment.
"We'll just have to check all of today, yesterday. Who knows? Weed didn't say exactly." "Maybe that call came in today. There's no record of that here." "It must be on the tape that's on the machine now. Those calls haven't been logged yet."
Marshall wound the tape back, put the machine into play, flipped on the speaker switch, and set the volume down low. Conversations began to unfold from the recording, a lot of everyday, innocuous stuff. Brummel's voice was in a lot of them, talking business. Marshall ran the tape ahead on fast-forward a few times, skipping over several conversations. Suddenly he recognized the voice, his own.
"You already ran once, remember?" came his recorded voice. "As long as you're alive, Eldon, you're going to be living with this, and they're going to know it." "Eldon Strawn and I," he told Bernice.
It was scary hearing his very words coming out of the machine, words that could tell the network anything and everything. Marshall skipped forward some more.
"Man, this whole thing is crazy," came a voice.
Bernice brightened.
"That's him. That's Weed."
Marshall wound the tape back and flipped it to play again. There was a gap, then the abrupt start of a conversation.
"Yeah, hello," said Weed. "Kevin, this is Susan."
Bernice and Marshall listened intently. Weed replied,
"Yeah, I'm listening, man. What can I do?"
Susan's voice was tense and her words hurried.
"Kevin, I'm getting out, one way or another, and I'm doing it tonight. Can you meet me at the Evergreen tomorrow night?"
"Yeah, yeah."
"See if you can bring Bernice Kruger with you. I have materials to show her, everything she needs to know."
"Man, this whole thing is crazy. You ought to see my place. Somebody came in here and tore it all up. You be careful."
"We're all in great danger, Kevin. Kasif's moving to Ashton to take over everything. But I can't talk now. Meet me at the Evergreen at 8. I'll try to get there somehow. If not, I'll call you."
"Okay, okay."
"I have to go. Goodbye, and thanks."
Click. The conversation was over.
"Yeah," said Bernice. "He called to tell me about this." "It wasn't much," said Marshall, "but it was enough. Now the only question is, did she manage to get away?"
A key rattled in the front door. Bernice and Marshall never moved so fast. She replaced all the files, and Marshall slid the machine back inside the cabinet. They closed the cabinet doors. The front door opened. The lobby lights came on. They ducked behind Brummel's big desk. Bernice's eyes were full of one question. "What do we do now?" Marshall gestured to her to keep cool. Then he made fists to show her they might have to fight their way out. Another key worked at Brummel's office door, and then it opened. Suddenly the room was flooded with light. They heard someone going to the cabinets, opening the doors, sliding out the machine. Marshall figured the person's back had to be toward them. He raised his head to take a quick peek. It was Carmen. She was winding the tape back to the beginning and preparing to make more entries in the record. Bernice took a look also, and both of them felt the same rage and indignation.
"Don't you ever sleep?"
Marshall asked Carmen right out loud. That startled Bernice, and she jumped a little. It startled Carmen, and she jumped a lot, dropped her papers, and gave a short little scream. She spun around.
"What?"
she gasped.
"What are you doing here?"
Marshall and Bernice both stood up. From their battered and dark-clothed appearance, this looked like anything but a nonchalant cordial visit.
"I might ask you the same thing," Marshall said. "Do you have any idea what time it is?"
Carmen looked them both over, and she was speechless. Marshall could certainly think of some things to say.
"You're a spy, aren't you? You were a spy in our office, you wiretapped our phones, and now you've run off with all our investigation materials."
"I don't know."
"What I'm talking about, right. So I suppose you do this every night, too. Go over all the recorded phone conversations and log them. Listen for anything the big boys might want to know."
"I wasn't..."
"And what about the Clarion's business records? Let's take care of that first."
She suddenly broke down crying,
Oh, you don't understand."
She went out into the reception area. Marshall was right on her heels, not about to let her out of his sight. He took her by the arm and spun her around.
"Easy, girl. We have some real business to take care of here."
"Oh,"
Carmen wailed. And then she threw her arms around Marshall as if she were a frightened child and sobbed into his chest.
"I thought you were some burglar. I'm glad it was you. I need help, Marshall."
"And we want answers," Marshall snapped back, unaffected by her tears. He sat her down in Sarah's old chair. "Have a seat and save your tears for some soap opera."
She looked up at both of them, her mascara running down her cheeks.
"Don't you understand? Don't you have any heart? I came here to help. I've just had a terrible experience."
She built up the strength to say it and then burst out in a fit of tears.
I've been raped."
She collapsed to the floor, sobbing uncontrollably. Marshall looked at Bernice, and Bernice looked at Marshall.
"Yeah," said Marshall unsympathetically. "There seems to be a lot of that going around these days, especially among the people your bosses want out of the way. So who was it this time?"
All she did was lie there on the floor and cry. Bernice had something boiling inside her.
"How do you like my looks tonight, Carmen? I think it's interesting that you were the only one who knew I'd be going out to visit Kevin Weed. Did you tip off the thug who beat me up?"
She still lay there on the floor crying, not saying a word. Marshall went into Brummel's office and returned with some of the files, including the notes Carmen had written that very night.
"It's all in your handwriting, Carmen, my dear. You've been nothing but a spy from the very beginning. Am I right or am I right?"
She kept crying. Marshall took hold of her, lifting her from the floor.
"Come on, get up."
It was just as he saw her hand come off the silent alarm button in the floor that the front door burst open and he heard a voice holler,
"Freeze! Police!"
Carmen was no longer crying. As a matter of fact, she was smirking. Marshall put his hands up, and so did Bernice. Carmen ran behind the two uniformed police who had just come in. Their guns were trained right on the two burglars.
"Friends of yours?" Marshall asked Carmen.
She only smiled an evil smile. Just then, Alf Brummel himself came into the building, fresh out of bed and in his bathrobe.
"What's going on here?"
he asked, and then he saw Marshall.
"What? Well, well, who do we have here?"
Then he actually chuckled a bit. He walked up to Marshall, shaking his head and showing those big teeth.
"I don't believe this. I just can't believe it."
He looked at Bernice.
"Bernice Kruger, is that you?"
Bernice had nothing to say, and Brummel was too far away to spit on. Oh, no, now they had a full house. Julene Langstrat, also in a bathrobe, walked in the door. She sidled up to Brummel, and the two of them stood there looking proudly at Marshall and Bernice as if they were trophies.
"Sorry for disturbing all of you like this," said Marshall.
Langstrat smiled lusciously and said,
"I wouldn't have missed this for the world."
Brummel kept on grinning with those big teeth and told the policeman,
"Read them their rights and take them into custody."
The opportunity was too good to pass up. There stood the two cops trying to do their job, and there were Brummel and Langstrath standing just a little in front of them. The situation was perfect, and it had been building up inside Marshall for a long time. Instantly, with all his weight, he dove into Brummel's stomach and toppled Brummel and Langstrath backward into the two cops.
"Run, Bernie, run!"
he shouted. She ran. She didn't stop to consider if she had the courage or the will or even the speed. She just ran for all she was worth, down the long hallway, past all the office doors, straight for the exit at the end. The door had a crash bar. She crashed into it, it opened, and she stumbled out into the cool night air. Marshall was in the middle of a tangle of arms, hands, bodies, and shouts, hanging on to as many of them as he could. He was almost enjoying it, and he didn't try that hard to get away. He wanted to keep them all busy. One cop recovered and ran after Bernice, bursting out through that back door. He was close enough on her trail to pick up the sound of footsteps heading up the back alley, and away he went in hot pursuit. Here was Bernice's chance to find out what kind of shape she was in, cracked rib and all. She chugged down the alley, taking long strides, making her way through the blurry dark. She longed for her glasses or at least a little more light. She heard the cop hollering at her to stop. Any moment he would fire that warning shot. She made a sharp left through a yard, and the dog started barking. There was a space of light between two low-hanging fruit trees. She headed for that and encountered a fence. Two garbage cans helped her over with a clatter that told the cop where she was. Bernice stomped through a freshly tilled garden, flattening several unseen bean poles. She ran onto a lawn, turned back toward the alley, knocked over some more cans, clambered over a fence, and kept running. The cop seemed to be fading back a little. She was getting desperately tired and could only hope that he was, too. She couldn't keep this up much longer. Every panting breath brought a sharp pain from that cracked rib. She couldn't breathe. She whipped around one house and doubled back through a few more yards, raising a tumult of barking from tattletale dogs, then crossed a street and dove into some woods. The branches lashed at her and entangled her, but she plowed through them until she reached another fence bordering a service station. She ran along the fence, found an old dumpster just on the other side, went just a little further, and then her eyes were attracted by a fragment of streetlight filtering through the leaves and illuminating a pile of rubbish some litter bug had dumped. She grabbed the first thing her hand found, an old bottle, then dropped to the ground, trying not to breathe too loudly, trying not to cry from the pain. The cop was moving rather slowly through the woods, groping his way along in the dark, snapping twigs under his feet, huffing and puffing. She lay there silently, waiting for him to pause and listen. Finally, he did stop and fall silent. He was listening. She pitched the bottle over the fence. It bounced off the top of the dumpster and shattered on the pavement behind the service station. The cop came crashing through the woods and up to the fence. He climbed over and stood still behind the station. Bernice could not see him from where she was, but she listened very intently. So did he. Then she heard him walk slowly along the back of the station and stop. A moment passed, and then he walked away at a normal pace. He had lost her. Bernice remained where she was, trying to calm the pounding of her heart and the rushing of blood in her ears, trying to calm her nerves and her panic, and wishing the pain would go away. All she wanted to do was gasp deep breaths of air. She couldn't seem to get enough. "Oh, Marshall, Marshall, what are they doing to you?" Chapter 32 Marshall was face down on the floor, his pockets emptied, his hands cuffed behind him. He was being very cooperative with the cop who stood over him with his gun drawn. Carmen, Brummel, and Langstrath were in Brummel's office going over the tape that Marshall and Bernice had listened to.
"Yes," said Carmen. "Here's my notation of the tape counter. I thought the tape hadn't run very far for such a long period of surveillance. The recordings continue after this stopping point. They wound the tape back."
Brummel stepped out of his office and stood over Marshall.
"So, what did you and Bernice listen to?"
"Big band jazz, I think," Marshall answered.
That response brought Brummel's heel down on Marshall's neck.
"Ow!"
Brummel had another question.
"So, who gave you the keys to this place? Did Sarah?"
"Ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies," Brummel muttered.
"I'll have to put out an APB on her, too."
"Don't bother,"
Langstrath said from the office.
She's gone now, and she's nothing. Don't bring trouble back once you're rid of it. Just concentrate on Kruger.
Brumell told the cop who was guarding Marshall, Ed, go out and see if you can help John. Kruger's the one we really need to round up. But just then John came back in through the door at the end of the hall, and he did not have Bernice in tow. Well? Brumell demanded. John only gave a timid shrug.
She ran like a scared rabbit, and it's dark out there.
Oh, terrific, Brumell moaned. Marshall thought it really was terrific. Langstrat's voice came from the office.
Alf, come listen to this.
Brumell went into his office, and Marshall could hear the conversation between Weed and Susan being replayed. Langstrat said,
So, they've heard this conversation. We picked it up from Susan's end today.
The dialogue between Susan and Weed came to an end.
Unless I miss my guess, Kruger could very well be headed for the Evergreen Tavern in Baker to meet Susan.
She broke into laughter. I'll have it staked out, then, said Brumell.
Get a stake out on her apartment, too. She'll want to get to her car.
Good idea. Brumell and Langstrat came out of the office and stood over Marshall like vultures over a carcass.
Marshall, Brumell gloated, you're in for quite a downhill slide, I'm afraid. I've got enough against you to put you away for good. You should have gotten out of this thing while you had the chance.
Marshall looked up at that silly grinning face and said,
To use a cliché, you'll never get away with this, Brumell. You don't own the whole court system. Sooner or later, this thing's going to go beyond your reach. It's going to get bigger than you are.
Brumell only smiled a smile that Marshall longed to kick into oblivion and said,
Marshall, a lower court decision is all we need, and I'm sure we can manage that. Let's face it, you're nothing but a liar and a third-rate burglar, not to mention a child molester and a possible murderer. We have witnesses, Marshall. Fine, upstanding citizens of this community. We'll see to it that you have the fairest of trials, so you would have no grounds for appeal. It could go very hard for you. The judge might give you a break, but, I don't know.
You mean Baker, the Wheeler dealer?
I understand he can be a very compassionate person under the right circumstances.
So don't tell me. You're going to book Bernice on charges of prostitution. Maybe you can dig up those hookers again, that bogus cop again, set the whole thing up.
Brumell chuckled mockingly.
That all depends on the evidence at hand, I guess. We can book her for burglary, you know. And the two of you set that one up yourselves.
So what about the laws against illegal wiretaps?
Langstrat answered that one.
We know of no wiretaps. We don't do that sort of thing.
She paused for effect, then added,
And they wouldn't find anything even if they did believe you.
Then something occurred to her.
Oh, and I can sense what you're thinking. Don't put your hopes in Susan Jacobson. We've received the sad news today that she was killed in a terrible motor vehicle accident. The only people Ms. Kruger can expect to meet at the Evergreen Tavern will be the police.
Bernice felt faint. Her ribcage felt like it was shattered. Her bruises throbbed without mercy. For the better part of an hour, she didn't have the strength or the nerves to get up from where she lay in the brambles. She tried to think what to do next. Every wisp of wind through the trees was an approaching policeman to her. Every sound brought new horror. She looked at her watch. It was going on 3 in the morning. Soon it would be day, and there would be no more sneaking around. She had to get moving, and she knew it. She slowly struggled to her feet, then stood there, slightly crouched under the low-hanging branches of a vine-tangled madrona, waiting for enough blood to circulate through her brain for her to stay standing. She took a step, then another. She gained confidence and started moving ahead, feeling her way through the trees and underbrush, trying to fend off the scratching branches. Back out on the street, it was quiet and dark. The dogs were no longer barking. She began to plot her course for her apartment, about a mile across town.
making the trip in quick dashes from tree to hedge to tree. Only once did a vehicle drive by, but it was not a squad car. Bernice hid behind a large maple tree until it had passed. She could not distinguish her physical pain and sickness from her emotional exhaustion and despair. A few times she got confused and lost her bearings, and couldn't make out any of the street signs, and it was then that she almost cried, slumping against a fence or a wall. But she remembered Marshall throwing himself into the jaws of those lions for her sake, and she couldn't let him down. She had to make it. She had to get out of town, get free, meet Susan, get help, do something. For nearly an hour, block by block, step by step, she worked her way along and finally approached her apartment building. She cautiously followed a circuitous route around it, wanting to check it from all sides. Finally, from behind a neighbor's station wagon, she thought she could make out the telltale rack of lights atop one car parked at the end of the block. From that position, the occupants of that car would have a perfect view of anyone trying to get into any apartment, so that was out. The back of the building was much easier to sneak into. There were small parking stalls along a dark, narrow alley. The lighting was poor. The parking stalls could not be seen from ground level up above. It was a terrible place to park a car in terms of security, but perfect for Bernice tonight. She darted across the street a block away and out of view of that squad car, then doubled back and slipped into the alley, staying close to the dank concrete retaining wall as the alley dipped down below the grade. She reached her Toyota, removed the little magnetic key box from under the bumper, and used those emergency keys to open the door. Oh, so near and yet so far. There was no way she could start her car and get away without being heard on this very still night. But there were some things she could make very good use of. She clambered in as quickly as she could and closed the door after her enough to extinguish the dome light. Then she opened the ashtray in the front console and emptied the quarters, dimes, and nickels into her pocket. Just a couple of bucks, but it would have to do. In the glove box she found her prescription sunglasses. Now she could see better and use them to conceal her black eyes. There was nothing else to do but get out of town, maybe get some sleep somewhere, somehow, and then one way or another get out to Baker and the Evergreen Tavern by 8 that coming night. That was all, but it was enough. She strained to think of anyone she knew that they would not know, any friend who could still aid and abet a fugitive from the law without questions. Her mental list of names was too short and too doubtful. She started walking, making her way toward Highway 27 while searching her mind for any other ideas. Down below the courthouse, alone in a cell at the end of the dismal cell block, Hank lay on his cot, asleep at last. It had not been the most enjoyable of evenings. They had stripped him, searched him, fingerprinted him, photographed him, and then stuck him in this cell with no blanket to keep warm. He had asked for a Bible, but they wouldn't allow him to have one. The drunk in the next cell had thrown up during the night, the writer of phony checks in the cell after that had a very dirty mouth, and the mugger in the next cell turned out to be a very vociferous, opinionated Marxist. Oh, well, he thought, Jesus died for them, and they need his love. He tried to be kind and share some of God's love with them, but someone had told them that he was an accused rapist, which put somewhat of a damper on his testimony. So he had lain down, identifying with Paul and Silas and Peter and James and every other Christian who had ever spent time in a forlorn prison, even though innocent. He wondered how long his ministry would survive now that his reputation had been so blasted. Would he still be able to hang on to his already shaky pastorate? Brummel and his buddies were sure going to make full use of this. For all he knew, they had been the ones who'd set it up. Ah, well, it was in the Lord's hands. God knew what was best. He prayed for Mary and for all his new motley sheep and mentally recited scripture to himself until he dropped off to sleep. In the very early hours of the morning, Hank was awakened by footsteps coming down the cell block and the jingle of the guard's jail keys. Oh, no. The guard was opening his cell door. Now Hank would have to share the cell with a drunk, a mugger, a real rapist. He pretended he was still asleep, but he opened one eye just a little to have a look. Oh, brother, the hoodlum was big and grim-looking, and from the bandage and bruise on his head it looked like he had just been in a brawl. He was muttering something about having to be stuck in a cell with a rapist. Hank started praying for the Lord's protection. This big character had to weigh twice as much as he did, and he looked violent. The new guy flopped down on the other cot and breathed that heavy kind of breath one associates with bears, dragons, and monsters.
Lord, please deliver me.
Rafar strutted back and forth on his hilltop overlooking the town, allowing his wings to trail and wave like a regal cape behind him. Demon messengers had been bringing him regular reports of how his final preparations of the town were going. So far, it had been nothing but good news.
Lucius,
Rafar called with the tone one would use in calling a child.
Lucius, come here, won't you?
Lucius stepped forward with all the dignity he could muster, trying to get his wings to wave and undulate like Rafar's.
Yes, Bale Rafar.
Rafar looked down at him gloatingly, a wry smile on his face, and said,
I trust you have learned from this experience, as you have so clearly seen, what you could not do in years, I have accomplished in days.
Perhaps.
That was all Lucius would give him. Rafar thought that was funny.
And you disagree?
One could think, Bale, that your work was merely the capstone of the years of my labor wrought before your coming.
Years of labor nearly undone by your blundering, you mean, Rafar retorted. Which does give one pause. Having won the town for the strong man, do I dare now leave it in the hands of one who nearly lost it before?
Lucius did not like the sound of that at all.
Rafar, for years this town has been my principality. I am the rightful prince of Ashton.
You were. But honors, Lucius, reward deeds, and in deeds I do find you lacking.
Lucius was indignant, but he controlled himself in the presence of this giant power.
You have not seen my deeds because you have not chosen to look. Your will was set against me from the beginning.
Lucius had said too much. Immediately he was snatched from the ground by Rafar's burly fist around his throat, and now Rafar held him up and looked him straight in the eye.
I, said Rafar slowly and fiercely, and only I am the judge of that.
Let the strong man judge,
Lucius responded very brazenly.
Where is this Tal, this adversary whom you were to vanquish, whose little pieces you were to hurl across the sky as your victory banner?
Rafar allowed a slight smile to cross his face, even though his eyes kept their fire.
Bush, the praying man, is defeated, and his name sullied. Hogan, the once tenacious hound, is now a worthless and defeated wretch. The traitor's maidservant is destroyed, and her scum of a friend is also eliminated. All others have fled.
Rafar waved his hand over the town.
Look, Lucius, do you see the fiery hosts of heaven descending over the town? Do you see their flashing and polished swords? Do you see their numberless guard posted around about?
He sneered at Lucius and Tal at the same time.
This Tal, this captain of the host, now commands a stricken and debilitated army, and he is afraid to show his face. Again and again I have defied him to confront me, to stop me. And he has not appeared. But don't worry. As I have spoken, so shall I do. When these other pressing matters are settled, Tal and I will meet, and you will see it take place just before I vanquish you.
Rafar held Lucius high as he called to another demon.
Hurry up. Take word to the strong man that all is ready and he may come at his will. The obstacles are removed. Rhaefar has completed his task, and the town of Ashton is ready to fall into his hands.
Rhaefar dropped Lucius as he said it.
Like a ripe plum.
Lucius bolted up from the ground and flew away in a humiliated flurry, while the demonic ranks laughed and laughed.
Chapter 33 Edith Duster had felt a certain stirring in her spirit before she went to bed that night. So, when she was awakened abruptly by two luminous beings in her bedroom, she was not entirely surprised, even though awestruck.
"Glory to God!"
she exclaimed, her eyes wide, her face enraptured. The two tall men had very kind and compassionate faces, but their expressions were serious. One was tall and blonde, the other dark-haired and youthful. Both towered as high as the ceiling, and the glow from their white tunics filled the room. Each had a magnificent golden scabbard and belt, and the handles of their swords were purest gold with fiery jewels.
"Edith Duster," said the big blonde one in a deep, resonant voice, "we are going into battle for the town of Ashton. The victory rests upon the prayers of the saints of God. As you fear the Lord, pray, and call others to prayer. Pray that the enemy will be vanquished, and the righteous delivered." Then the dark-haired one spoke. "Your pastor, Henry Bush, has fallen prisoner. He will be delivered through your prayers. Call Mary, his wife. Be a comfort to her." Suddenly they were gone, and the room was dark once again. Edith knew somehow that she had seen them before, perhaps in dreams, perhaps as unimpressive normal people here and there, and she knew the importance of their request. She rose and grabbed her pillow, placed it on the floor, and then knelt upon it there beside the bed. She wanted to laugh, she wanted to cry, she wanted to sing. There was a burden and a power deep within her, and she clasped her shaking hands together there upon the bed, bowed her head, and began to pray. The words flowed forth from her deepest soul, an outcry on behalf of God's people and God's righteousness, a plea for power and victory in the name of Jesus, a binding of the evil forces that were trying to take the very life, the very heart of that community. Names and faces cascaded before her mind's eye, and she interceded for all of them, pleading before the throne of God for their safety and salvation. She prayed. She prayed. She prayed. From high above, the town of Ashton was spread out like an innocent toy village on a patchwork quilt, a small and unpretentious community still sleeping, but now awash with the slowly rising flood of pre-dawn gray and pink that grew over the mountains in the east. As yet, nothing stirred in the town. There were no lights being switched on. The milk truck was still parked. From somewhere in the skies beyond the pink-edged clouds, a solitary rushing sound began. One angelic warrior, soaring like a gull, spiraled quickly and covertly downward until his form was lost in the patterns and textures of the streets and buildings far below. Then another appeared, and he too dropped quietly into the town, disappearing somewhere within it. And Edith Duster kept praying. Two appeared, their wings swept back, their heads sharply downward, diving like hawks into the town. Then came another, gliding along a more shallow path that would carry him to the far side of town. Then four, dropping in four different directions. Then two more. Then seven. Mary was awakened from fitful sleep on the couch by the telephone.
"Hello?"
Her eyes brightened immediately.
"Oh, Edith, I'm so glad you called. I've been trying to reach you. I haven't even gone to bed. I must have your number written down wrong, or the phones aren't working."
Then she started crying and told Edith all about the events of the previous night.
"Well, you just rest and be quiet until I get there," said Edith. "I've been on my knees all night, and God is moving. Yes, he is. We'll get Hank out of there and more besides."
Edith grabbed her sweater and her sneakers and was off to Mary's house. She had never felt younger.
John Coleman awoke early that morning, so shaken by a dream he couldn't get back to sleep. Patricia knew the feeling. The same thing had happened to her.
"I saw angels," John said.
"I did too," said Patricia.
And I saw demons, monsters, Patty. Hideous things. The angels and the demons were fighting it out. It was
terrible.
Awesome. Really awesome.
They called Hank. Mary answered. They got the story of last night and then went right over. Andy and June Forsythe couldn't sleep all that night. This morning, Andy was crabby, and June just tried to stay out of his way. Finally, as Andy tried to eat some breakfast, he was able to talk about it.
"It must be the Lord. I don't know what else it could be."
"But why are you so crabby?" June asked as tenderly as she could.
"Because I've never felt this way before," Andy said, and then his voice started to quiver. I just feel like I have to pray, like something's really got to be settled, and I can't rest until it is."
"You know," said June, "I really know what you mean. I don't know if I can explain it, but I feel like we haven't been alone all night. Somebody's been here with us, filling us with these feelings."
Andy got wide-eyed.
"Yeah, that's it. That's the feeling."
He grabbed her hand with great joy and relief.
"June, honey, I thought I was going crazy."
Just then the phone rang. It was Cecil Cooper. He had had a very disturbing dream that night, and so had many others. Something was up. They didn't wait to gather to pray. They started praying right then and there. From north, from south, from east and west, from all directions, and so very silently, heavenly warriors continued to drop into the town like snowflakes, walk into the town like people, sneak into the town like guerrillas, glide through fields and orchards into the town like bush pilots. Then they hid themselves and waited. Hank woke at about 7. The nightmare had not ended. He was still in the cell. His new cellmate continued snoring for another hour until the guard brought in breakfast. The big man said nothing but took the little plate that was handed through the bars. He didn't look too excited about the burnt toast and cold eggs. Perhaps this would be the time to break the ice.
"Good morning," Hank said.
"Good morning," the big man replied very half-heartedly.
"My name is Hank Bush."
The big man slid his plate out under the door for the guard to pick up. He hadn't touched the food. He stood there looking out through the bars like a caged animal. He did not respond to Hank's introduction, nor did he tell Hank his name. He was obviously hurting. His eyes seemed so longing and so vacant. All Hank could do was pray for him. Step, step, stumble, then step again. All morning long, through fields of corn, pastures of cows, thick forests, Bernice trudged along, slowly making her way north on a meandering route that ran roughly parallel to Highway 27, somewhere off to her left. The sound of the vehicles roaring along the highway helped her to get her bearings. She was beginning to trip over her own feet, her thoughts getting sluggish. Row upon row of cornstalks marched past her, their big green leaves brushing against her with a steady, almost annoying rhythm. The dirt under her feet was softly tilled and dusty. It was working into her shoes. It absorbed the strength from her strides. After crossing the sea of corn, she came to a very long and very narrow grove of trees, a windbreak planted between the fields. She went into the middle of it and immediately found a patch of soft grassy ground. She checked her watch. 8:25 a.m. She had to rest. She would get to Baker somehow. It was the only hope. She hoped Marshall was okay. She hoped she wouldn't die. She was asleep. By the time lunch was brought in, Hank and his cellmate were a little more ready to eat. The sandwiches weren't that bad, and the beef vegetable soup was quite good. Before the guard got away, Hank asked him,
"Say, are you sure I couldn't have a Bible somehow?"
"I told you," the guard said rudely. "I'm waiting on authorization, and until I get it, no dice."
Suddenly, the big silent cellmate burst out.
Jimmy, you got a stack of Gideon Bibles in your desk drawer, and you know it. Now give the man a Bible.
The guard only sneered at the man. Hey, you're on that side of the bars now, Hogan. I'll run the show out here. The guard left, and the big man tried to shift his attention to his lunch. He looked up at Hank, though, and quipped,